the month of March, Women's History Month. And we've had a book in front of me here that's called The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We've got with us the author of it, Elaine Weiss. Good morning, Elaine. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
So we are talking about the women and getting the right to vote. And part of the introduction that's very interesting to me is, has winning the vote required 72 years of ceaseless agitation by three generations of dedicated, fearless suffragists who sought to overturn centuries of law and millennia of tradition concerning gender roles? The women who launched the movement were dead by the time it was completed. The women who secured the final success weren't born when it began. It took 900 local, state, and national campaigns involving tens of thousands of grassroots volunteers, financed by millions of dollars and mostly small, few large donations by women across the country. So we think of sort of this time when women were fighting for the right to vote sort of as a compressed time. Take us back, I guess, through those decades. Did it ebb and flow, or was there sort of a continual movement to the point that they finally got the right to vote?
Well, I think you describe it well. There's both an ebb and flow, and there's a continual movement. It begins in the middle of the 19th century. You know, we've all heard of Seneca Falls, which is one of the first women's rights conferences, where Elizabeth Cady Stanton stands up and demands that women have the right to vote. She also demands that women get equal pay for equal work. This is 1848. But the movement moves slowly because they're not only wanting to change the law and give women the most fundamental right of a democracy, which they've been denied all this time, but they really have to change hearts and minds. They have to convince women and then convince men that they need and want the vote. And they're not just changing political and legal status. They're really changing, they're challenging the role of women in society, whether she's just a mother and wife, or whether she can aspire to be a true and full citizen. So it's a much more complicated societal change. And that means it was, there are antagonists, there are people who are against it, including organized groups of women who are against it. But they are moving towards, some states allow their women to vote. Many states do not. And so the only way to get all women in every election in every state allowed to vote is through a constitutional amendment. And that amendment is introduced into Congress in 1878, and it sits there for 40 years. The men in Congress sit on it, shuffle it around, throw it into the file cabinets, and finally it emerges after World War I. In June of 1919, so we're about to celebrate that centennial very soon. And then it said it goes out to the states, and three-quarters of the states, and there are 48 at the time, have to ratify the amendment for it to become part of the Constitution. And so my book takes place during the fight for the final state, the 36th state, and that happens to be in Tennessee.
Elaine, you mentioned that some women back in the day were organized. They did not want the right to vote. Why not?
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? I was really shocked when I found that in my research. But there were lots of reasons, and different women had different reasons. Some saw it as against the will of God, and many clergy were telling them that, too, that God had formed Adam to be dominant over Eve, and for Eve to demand equal rights went against biblical teaching. And so for some, it was a religious question. For others, they felt that women's sphere, her place, was just in the home, you know, rocking that cradle, and she should not be seen in public. Women weren't supposed to be even speak in public. That was considered totally unorthodox and unacceptable. And so you have these women who are socially or politically or religiously conservative saying, no, this is going to change gender roles. They argue there'll be more divorces because men and women will argue about politics. They say that it will emasculate men if women also have the vote. And they're not subtle about it. They have advertisements and broadsides that show, you know, women with a whip and a man hovering under the bed. And they show pictures of women waltzing off to vote and leaving their husbands and wives, their husbands and children, and daddies having to hold the screaming infants. And so this whole idea of this, allowing women to vote, is going to open up a Pandora's box. It's going to destroy the American home. And they say that. And they say this is going to be the moral downfall of the nation. So, and then you have women who have other reasons for opposing it. In the South, there are women who oppose it because it will allow black women to vote. And they don't want that. They see that as a threat to their social hierarchies in the South. So it's complicated and it's fascinating because we never think about women opposing their own enfranchisement.
Right. We look back 100 years at what it was, and sometimes from far distance we think, well, that's kind of crazy. Why are they thinking that way? But sometimes we realize we're in a situation, here we are in 2019. What sort of similarities do we bring that we think we don't have, biases or whatever, that we don't have in the political climate with many women now running for, you know, the highest office in the land and electing many different people to our different political positions?
Absolutely. And so you have now, again, the largest representation of women in the U.S. Congress. There are 25 women senators and I believe 106 representatives. And there are women governors and mayors and at all levels. And so now you also see them attacked for, you know, about not being feminine enough, not smiling enough, being too aggressive. These are the same sorts of complaints that were made against the suffragists. They were depicted as ugly and mannish and too assertive. So I almost kind of laugh when I see some of the ridiculous comments being made now about women candidates, because I say, wow, I remember reading that from 100 years ago, or 150 years ago. That's how women who were standing up for their rights were depicted. But it was also a time, as now, when we're deciding what is our role in the world as Americans, and also what does our democracy mean? We're still facing the idea that voting is not for everyone, because we see voter suppression, we see gerrymandering. These are the threats to our democracy that we have to now confront. It's no longer just discrimination against women in the vote. It's against minorities. It's against people of a different party than the ruling party in a particular state or jurisdiction. And we have to be really careful that we do not undermine our democracy by allowing this sort of voter suppression. And on the other hand, we don't have very good participation in our voting, in our elections. The percentages of those who vote are really frighteningly small. And so we have to, as citizens, look at ourselves and say, you know, do we believe in democracy? Well, then we have to participate. And that's what the suffragists were fighting for.
And we realized through that book, realizing what they went through, and you think, okay, now that we have the right to vote, why aren't we going out on that Tuesday to cast our ballot after?
Absolutely. And I think one of the most gratifying things that I heard from some of my readers was after the last November elections, and some wrote to me and said, I took your book into the voting booth with me for inspiration. So I really like that. I like the idea of my book helping people to realize how important the vote is.
Our guest today, Elaine Weiss, the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Elaine, thanks for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.